Good morning to you, brethren, and those who are visiting. We are thankful to be together this Lord's Day morning. I'm going to ask you this morning to juggle three places in your Bible. Turn to Exodus chapter 2, Acts chapter 7, and Hebrews chapter 11. Acts chapter 7 and Hebrews chapter 11. So while you're finding those places, let me thank the elders for this opportunity to speak in Steve's absence while he's away preaching in a meeting. And I hope and pray that our study together will be profitable. If I were to show you this image and ask you to think about what that might mean to you, it certainly is cultural right now, has been a cultural issue in the past year or so, maybe even longer than that. To find an identity crisis is a period of uncertainty and confusion in which a person's sense of identity becomes insecure for one reason or another. And we've really seen this at play, again, as I said, the last few years, on how one identifies sexually. The sexual identity crisis that's gripped our nation, certainly furthered by the powerful homosexual movement and lobby. Now, that's not going to be my topic this morning. That's just an example of what we're talking about in terms of when someone has that kind of an identity crisis. I want to consider with you another identity crisis this morning that we all face. One that's, if a person is interested in faithfully following the Lord, faithfully in doing what the Lord's Word would teach and say, a spiritual identity crisis. This is certainly appropriate for all of us, but especially for our young people. We have some who are going off to college or returning to college, and they face pressures. We all face pressures. We have some who are starting their families. They've been married for a little while, and now they're adding children, and so they have new duties, parental responsibilities that is unfamiliar to them, and so they want to make sure they do those things in the right way. Knowing who I am deep down in the very core of my being, that's what we're talking about. And we're going to illustrate this morning with the life of a very familiar Bible character. That is the life of Moses. I believe we can learn some things about Moses as he struggled at times and he tried to come to grips with who he really was. Make some applications for you and I today. So let's first start, and we'll take his life in stages. Let's first start with what I'm going to call his birth and his early years. So let's read these passages together. Exodus chapter 2, the first nine verses, then we'll jump to Acts 7 and then Hebrews 11. Exodus 2, starting in verse 1. Now a man from the house of Levi went and married a daughter of Levi. Woman conceived and bore a son, and when she saw that he was beautiful, she hid him for 3 months. But when she could hide him no longer, she got him a wicker basket and covered it over with tar and pitch. Then she put the child into it and set it among the reeds by the bank of the Nile. His sister stood at a distance to find out what would happen to him. The daughter of Pharaoh came down to bathe at the Nile with her maidens walking alongside the Nile. And she saw the basket among the reeds and sent her maid, and she brought it to her. When she opened it, she saw the child, and behold, the boy was crying. And she had pity on him and said, "This is one of the Hebrews' children." Then his sister said to Pharaoh's daughter, "Shall I go and call a nurse for you from the Hebrew women, that she may nurse the child for you?" Pharaoh's daughter said to her, "Go ahead." So the girl went and called the child's mother. Then Pharaoh's daughter said to her, "Take this child away and nurse him for me, and I will give you your wages." So the woman took the child and nursed him. Now, Acts chapter 7, just verse 20 by itself. In Stephen's speech, Stephen says this: "It was about this time that Moses was born, And he was lovely in the sight of God, and he was nurtured 3 months in his father's home. Then Hebrews 11, verse 23, by itself. Hebrews writer says this, by faith Moses, when he was born, was hidden for 3 months by his parents because they saw he was a beautiful child and they were not afraid of the king's edict. So that gives us a pretty complete picture of what's going on in this, what we're calling his early years. So in one's life, these are what we're going to call those influencing factors as one's life begins. Generally, these aren't under that person's control because we're infants. We're a small person. We can't make many decisions for ourselves. But these factors begin to influence us. They begin to affect us and help mold our character. Look at Moses' life, for example. Look at the strong faith of Amram and Jochebed. Pharaoh had made the decree. They weren't afraid of that. They trusted God in that. And they made their decision. He was a beautiful child. And so they were going to keep him and nurture him and raise him to be a child of the covenant, despite the king's edict. Look at the compassion of Pharaoh's daughter. I'm going to call that providential. She noticed that he was the child of the Hebrew. She said so when she saw the baby in the basket. I'm quite sure she knew of her father's edict. I would think that she would know that. But she didn't destroy the child. She had compassion. And God was going to use that in helping Moses' life to continue. Look at Miriam's suggestion. Miriam was off hiding off to the side when the daughter of Pharaoh found Moses in the basket. And so she runs up to the daughter of Pharaoh and says, shall I go call a nurse? And she goes and gets the child's mother, of all people. Goes and gets Jochebed, that she may nurse. So a woman's going to get paid to nurse her own child. Providential, I would say. And then Moses' early training at home under Jochebed's care. I mean, that's implied. While she's nursing, I think she taught him, reared him, nurtured him, molded him, as much as you can mold the character of an infant, but she was doing those things because he was, in fact, her child. So in these early years, we have those kinds of activities going on in a person's life. They may not amount to much tangibly at that moment, but they're steps along the way. And we can see that those who give such care to children, that's exactly why they're doing what they're doing. Now, let's go to the next part of Moses' life, what I'll call his formative years. Back to Exodus 2, just one verse, verse 10. Moses writes this, the child grew, and she brought him to Pharaoh's daughter, and he became her son. And she named him Moses, and said, because I drew him out of the water. And Acts chapter 7, verses 21 to 22. Stephen continues with these two verses. And after he had been set outside, Pharaoh's daughter took him away and nurtured him as her own son. And Moses was educated in all the learning of the Egyptians, and he was a man of power in words and in deeds. So what about this section of Moses' life as he's continuing to be nurtured? Well, this is when one begins to form character as the child grows. And I've often heard it phrased this way, and to me it makes a lot of sense. A person will grow and develop his or her character either because of or in spite of those influential years. Let me repeat that. You, I, anyone will begin to form our character either because of someone or in spite of someone. This is when we begin to make our own choices. We begin to age and grow and begin to reason a little more than we could when we were smaller, and so we begin to think things through. We're not a full-fledged adult just yet, but we're on the way. And again, these would be factors that are both chosen and what I'm going to call cultural. That would be choices others make who have some influence on the culture in which one lives. For example, look at the fact that he grew up in two different environments. Here was a modest Hebrew home where love was and where faith in God was governing that environment. And then when that ended, then he went to this spacious Egyptian palace, where God was not respected. God was not revered. They had their own gods. So two different environments. And Moses' education. He had no control over how he was going to be indoctrinated, but again, as Stephen says in Acts 7, he was educated in all the learning of the Egyptians. Music and art and culture and history and so forth and so on. But again, he's going to be influenced. He's going to be schooled in that. And that will have a bearing on his character formation. I'm quite sure of that. So again, these are those formative years. Now let's get to the last part of his life that we'll study today. And we're going to call this the action years, or this is where the crisis hits in all of us. So let's go back to Exodus 2 and finish up now verses 11 through 19. Moses will write this about himself. Exodus 2, starting in verse 11. Now it came about in those days when Moses had grown up that he went out to his brethren and looked on their hard labors. And he saw an Egyptian beating a Hebrew, one of his brethren. So he looked this way and that, and when he saw that there was no one around, he struck down the Egyptian and hid him in the sand. He went out the next day, and behold, two Hebrews were fighting with each other. And he said to the other, or to the offender, "Why are you striking your companion?" But he said, "Who made you a prince or judge over us? Are you intending to kill me as you killed the Egyptian?" Then Moses was afraid and said, "Surely the matter has become known." When Pharaoh heard of this matter, he tried to kill Moses, but Moses fled from the presence of Pharaoh and settled in the land of Midian, and he sat down by a well. Now the priest of Midian had seven daughters, and they came to draw water and filled the troughs to water their father's flock. Then shepherds came and drove them away, but Moses stood up and helped them and watered their flock. When they came to rule their father, he said, "Why have you come back so soon today?" They said, "An Egyptian delivered us from the hand of the shepherds. And what is more, he even drew water for us and watered the flock." Now back to Acts 7, verse 23. Stephen adds this little bit of different comments. When he was approaching the age of 40, it entered his mind to visit his brethren, the sons of Israel. And when he saw one of them being treated unjustly, he defended him and took vengeance for the oppressed by striking down the Egyptian. And he supposed that his brethren understood that God was granting them deliverance through him, but they did not understand. On the following day, he appeared to them as they were fighting together, and he tried to reconcile them in peace, saying, "Men, you are brethren. Why do you injure one another?" But the one who was injuring his neighbor pushed him away, saying, "Who made you a ruler and judge over us? You do not mean to kill me as you killed the Egyptian yesterday, do you?" And at this remark, Moses fled and became an alien in the land of Midian, where he became the father of two sons. And we'll read the Hebrews passage just in a moment together. So again, this is the crisis years. Now this is the moment in one's life where we finally have to wrestle with the question, who am I? Where am I going? What's the direction of my life? I've been raised from infancy through those formative years. There's been cultural things foisted upon me, things I have rejected, things I've accepted, whatever they may be, but I've lived through those years. Now I'm on my own. I can make my own decisions. What kind of person will I be? This is how one finally decides to identify. We'll have maybe soul-searching questions. Peer pressure is brought to bear upon us. Oftentimes in this phase of one's life, there's assumptions made and we come to the wrong decisions. Look again at Acts 7. Look at verse 25 that we read a moment ago. When Moses was taking vengeance and struck down the Egyptian, look what he supposed or he assumed. Verse 25, he supposed that his brethren understood that God was going to grant them deliverance through him. But it wasn't going to be through his mind. Not that way. It's going to be God's way. But Moses made an assumption. Moses came to an incorrect conclusion. And oftentimes, in this phase of one's life, we do that. And we have to work that out. So why did Moses act this way? Did you catch back in Exodus 2 and verse 19 when Zipporah, she's not named that, but that's, I think, who the daughter was, she gets back to her father, Jethro, or Reuel, and he says, "Why are you back so early?" Did you catch what she said in verse 19? She said, "An Egyptian delivered us." Why would she say an Egyptian? Because he looked like an Egyptian. That's where he had been living all this time. So he looked like that culture. But that's not who he was. We know that because of his inward decision. In Acts 7 and verse 23, Stephen said this, "But when he was approaching the age of 40, it entered his mind to visit his brethren." How do you know who his brethren were? How did he know that? Well, there's two possibilities. Again, back in Exodus 2, the daughter of Pharaoh, she knew him to be an Israelite because she said so. And maybe while she had him after he was through being weaned in the house of his parents and he began to live with her, maybe she said one day, "You know, you really aren't Egyptian, you're a Hebrew." She could have told him that. But I rather would guess that while he was in his parents' home, Jochebed taught him. While she's nursing him, she's schooling him, she's teaching him, she's training him, as all good mothers do with their children. Let me pause here and make an application to our young mothers. While you have your children at home, teach them. Yeah, feed them, clothe them, all those things that require the care of a child. But while you have your children, teach them the Bible. Read them the stories of Abraham and Moses. Read them the gospel of Jesus Christ. Teach them what a New Testament saint ought to be. And instill in them those Bible-based stories. Why? Well, to help them form that right kind of character when they get older. That's what good parents do. And I rather believe that's how Moses knew who his brethren were. Because he had been taught by his mother, "These are our people. This is who I really am. Despite what I look like, this is who I really am." So Moses could no longer be on the outside what he was way down deep, or what he wasn't way down deep on the inside. He's not an Egyptian at heart. Again, he may have looked like one, but that's not who he is. Who was Moses? Moses was a child of Abraham by covenant. He was a Hebrew. God was his father. And he knew that now his outward actions would have to match his inward decision. They've got to harmonize. They've got to be in concert one with another. I can't play pretend and look this way, act this way, and say, "Well, I'm this way." It doesn't work that way, does it? Not at all. He is a covenant child of God. So now to Hebrews 11. It's on the screen. You can turn to your Bibles if you want to read this very familiar passage with me. Look at this together. Hebrews 11, verse 24. The writer says this. Very familiar verses. "By faith Moses, when he had grown up, refused to be called the son of Pharaoh's daughter, choosing rather to endure ill treatment with the people of God than to enjoy the passing pleasures of sin, considering the reproach of Christ greater riches than the treasures of Egypt, for he was looking to the reward." Let's dissect this passage a little bit together next few moments. Verse 24, when Moses had grown up, again, the writer doesn't say, but harmonizing with Acts 7, he's 40. As Stephen said, he refused to be called an Egyptian. This word refused means to not accept something, to refuse or to reject something out of hand, to not take something that's been offered. That's what Moses did. Same words in Acts 3 and verse 14 in Peter's second sermon when he says to the Jews, "But you disowned or rejected, denied the Holy and Righteous One and asked for a murderer to be granted to you." It's the same meaning. That's what Moses did. "I'm not going to accept the identity of an Egyptian. That's not who I am." He refused that. But rather, the writer said, now back in Hebrews 11, he chose rather to endure ill treatment with the people of God. This word choosing, it means to take for oneself, to prefer something to a higher degree. I reject that, but I choose this. That's what that means. Again, same words in Philippians 1. When Paul says in verse 21, "For to me to live is Christ and die is gain." But then verse 22, "But if I'm to live on in the flesh, this will mean fruitful labor for me, and I do not know which one to choose. Do I leave the earth and go be with the Lord, or do I stay here and work with you? I don't know which one to pick or to choose." That's what that word means, to take something to oneself. I prefer this. This is my decision by choice. That's what Moses did. Now our third term back in this passage. He considered the reproach of Christ greater riches This word considering means to count something, to consider or to deem something, to esteem something exceedingly, to think about something, weigh the options out, and say, that's what I pick for these reasons. Back to Philippians chapter 2 this time. Paul says in verse 3, do nothing from selfishness or empty conceit, but with humility of mind regard, your version may say esteem one another, as more important than yourselves. That's the idea of considering or esteeming. And again, verse 6, speaking about Christ, although he existed in the form of God, did not regard equality or esteem or count something to be grasped or held on to. That's what Moses did. He looked ahead beyond his immediate moment and looked at what was available later down the road. That's better than this right now. And that's what he made that decision. Again, this is all helping him identify who he really is. He put these in and used these as criteria to make his decision. And then finally in this passage, he was looking to the reward. This is the only time this word appears in the New Testament. I really like this definition. It means this: to turn the eyes away from other things and fix them only on one thing. To turn the eyes away from other things, plural, and fix them only on one thing and one thing only. Tunnel vision, focused vision. Now, without going into too much technicality about the original language, but I think this might be helpful just to think about these first three. When Moses refused, when Moses chose, when Moses considered. The tense of these were decisive, completed actions in and of themselves. No waffling, no back and forth. Do you recall in 1 Kings chapter 18, when Elijah is on Mount Carmel, and he asked the Israelites, how long will you waffle between two opinions? If Baal is God, choose him. If Jehovah is God, choose him. And they were silent. They didn't answer. Why? Because they were waffling back and forth. This day it's this day it's that. No, these words tell us that when Moses refused, that was a done deal. He refused it once and it stayed refused. When Moses chose, that was a done deal. He chose it once and it stayed chosen. It's character-based decisions. When Moses considered the reproaches of Christ, it stayed that way. He didn't hesitate. He didn't change his mind a few days later or the next month or the next year. It takes character to do that. And Moses did that. But this last word, looking, it's in the continuous action. He looked and he kept on looking and he would not quit looking. It's a long-term decision. Moses kept on looking. Moses kept on shunning his eyes from other things and kept on putting his eyes fixed only on the prize that he valued the most, the reproaches of Christ. That's what takes character to do those kinds of things. And Moses had finally developed that character. And you and I can develop that character if we're serious about serving the Lord. So, Moses knew that he had a principal decision to make in his life. And what I decide today, it's going to affect the rest of my life. And transferring this now to us, when we raise our children, besides deciding it for ourselves, but with those that we're in charge of, we help them make these decisions. We help them think these things through and say that this is why we decide what we do, because of these important reasons. That's what's building character. That's what's helping us identify who we truly are as God's people. So Moses could have chosen all the splendor of Egypt, couldn't he? There's rare treasures, this rich heritage, living in the finest of palaces, maybe even the throne possibly one day. We don't know. Maybe that was on the table. If not, that's the environment he was living in. Privilege, power, refinement, prestige, all that could have been Moses. Moses's. Or it was this on the other side. Israel's anguish, deep poverty, slavery, harsh contempt at the hands of the Egyptians, utter affliction, bitter affliction, a bleak future, 400 years of slavery. There were probably hundreds and thousands of Hebrews in that time of slavery who were born, who lived, and who died, not seeing the deliverance at the hands of the Egyptians. Slavery, oppression, burdens, a life of no hope. That's the two options. Now, go out and poll the average person on the street. Which one would you take? Well, hands down, it's the one on the left. Obviously. Who would choose that? For no reason. Nobody would. But Moses, see, he's now come to grips with who he really is. His character has been formed. And he chose the one on the right. Why would he reject the pleasures on the left? Back to Hebrews 11 and verse 25. Because they're passing, that's why. They're fleeting. They don't last. They're just momentary. I'm more eternal than those things are. I'm going to outlive those pleasures. And there's things that I want, there's things that I need to be, and things that I need to do that are far greater than those. That was Moses' decision. And now Moses has come to grips with who he really is. What was his identity? I'm a child of the covenant. I'm a child of God. And so I make my choices based upon that. So each of us face this same crisis. You face it, I face it. If we have children, they're going to face it. In an increasingly growing world of paganism and irreverence toward God and His Word and the things that are meaningful and eternal, I would venture to say, I have no problem saying this, I think the world's worse today than it was when I was growing up. It's got to be. Because there's temptations out there that didn't exist when I was a small child, a teenager. The war's just getting worse. Things wax worse and worse, Paul writes in the New Testament. So, what is my true identity? Again, I say, this is particularly critical for those of you who are going off to college. You're living on your own now. And you'll have to face these and make the right decisions. So, will I conform to the plans that God has for me or not? Look in Matthew 25. Jesus, in telling that great parable of the sheep and the goats, the judgment scene, if you will. Matthew 25. Two statements stand out to me when he's addressing each category. Look in verse 34. The king will say to those on his right, that is the sheep, "Come, you who are blessed of my Father, inherit the kingdom prepared for you from the foundation of the world." God prepared a place for you. God prepared a kingdom for you. And you've faithfully served me. Now take your place in that prepared place. Look also at verse 41. To the goats, he says, on the left, "Depart from me, accursed ones, into the eternal fire which has been prepared for the devil and his angels." See, both heaven and hell are prepared places. Did you notice the difference here? Hell was never, ever, it was not in God's mind to prepare hell for any human. It was prepared for the devil and his angels. But heaven's prepared for people. And that's where the Lord wants you. That's where He wants me. Even though I don't deserve it. But that's where He wants me. Look in 2 Corinthians chapter 5. This is a little lengthy reading, but I think it's worth our time. Just for a moment, look at 2 Corinthians 5. Especially the way it concludes. Starting at the start of the chapter, verse 1 of 2 Corinthians 5. Paul says this, "For we know that if the earthly tent which is our house is torn down, we have a building from God, a house not made with hands, eternal in the heavens. For indeed in this house we groan, longing to be clothed with our dwelling from heaven, inasmuch as we, having put it on, will not be found naked. For indeed, while we are in this tent, we groan, being burdened, because we do not want to be unclothed, but to be clothed, so that what is mortal will be swallowed up in life," or by life. Verse 5, "Now he who prepared us for this very purpose is God, who gave to us the Spirit as a pledge. Therefore, being always of good courage, and knowing that while we are at home in the body, we are absent from the Lord, for we walk by faith, not by sight. We are of good courage, I say, and prefer rather to be absent from the body and to be at home with the Lord. Therefore, we also have as our ambition, that is to say, this desire within us to make the right character-based decision as our ambition, whether at home or absent, to be pleasing to Him. We must all appear before the judgment seat of Christ, so that each one may be recompensed for his deeds in the body, according to what he has done, whether good or bad. But verse 5 is the clincher in this. God's prepared a plan. He schemed this redemptive process out for you, for me. And he wants us to make the right decisions. We have eternity in our hearts, Ecclesiastes 3 and verse 11 says. We're a lot more than the baubles and trinkets we see all around us flashing and glittering every day. That we have to make these decisions. These prophetic statements of old, they do not really specifically apply to me and you, but they ring just as true as when they were uttered years ago. Jeremiah 1 and verse 5. Before I formed you in the womb, I knew you, Jehovah says. He knows you intimately. He's your maker. Jeremiah 29 verse 11. For I know the plans that I have for you, declares the Lord. Plans for welfare and not for calamity, to give you a future and a hope. That's what God plans for you and God plans for me. Two final quotes that I'll share with you. One is uninspired and one is inspired. The end of April, I was pleased to hear Brother Bill Hall, who we know, brethren, adore that man, and he's earned that adoration. Hear him in a sermon up in Ardmore on a Sunday afternoon. His theme for the series was there's power in the blood and the word, and there's power in Jesus, and that was the theme of the meeting. And the lesson I heard was there's power in the word that Sunday afternoon. Here's what he said at the end of his lesson in the theme of there's power in the word. Isn't it time that we got serious about the word of God in our daily lives? This word can change you and make you who you really ought to be. So isn't it time we get serious about that? And to that we say amen. Yes, it's time we get serious about it. So that's the uninspired quote. Turn to 1 Peter 4 as we end our lesson together. And I like the way the New King James renders this passage. 1 Peter 4, starting in verse 1. Peter says this, therefore, since Christ suffered for us in the flesh, arm yourselves with the same mind. See, it's a mindset. For he who has suffered in the flesh has ceased from sin, that he no longer should live the rest of his time in the flesh for the lusts of men, but for the will of God. For we have spent enough of our past lifetime in doing the will of the Gentiles. That's what Brother Hall said. See, we've done that long enough. Let's not do that anymore. And what I'm saying to myself and to you this morning, as we think about this great Bible character of Moses, is that may God help each of us individually and purposefully have the depth of faith that Moses had as he came to grips with these moments in his life where he had to decide. And he finally made the principled decision. This is who I am. This is how I'm going to live. This is what I want for my eternal future. And that's your question and my question this morning. So to those of you who are not disciples of Jesus Christ, you've never obeyed the gospel. Well, you have an identity crisis. We all do. What will you decide? How will you spend your eternity? Will you hear those words, Matthew 25, come to me and inherit the kingdom prepared for you? Or will you hear those words, depart from me into the place prepared for the devil and his angels? You need to obey the Lord this morning. Put him on in baptism after having confessed he's the Christ and repented of sin. And then you'll start living in this unbelieving world, but with a fresh new identity, a new self, a new creature. Or those of us who have obeyed the Lord in the past, but we've not been living the way we ought to. We got this same crisis, don't we? Who am I really? What am I really all about? How am I conducting myself? So perhaps there's something in your life that needs to be corrected this morning. If it's privately, then go home and get on your knees and beg the Father to forgive you. And then vow that I'm going to do better. But if you've done something publicly that needs to be corrected, then come to the front. We'll help you confess that sin and pray with you, that you may have that purposed, eternal destiny that God has planned for you. So whatever your need is, we're going to sing this hymn to invite you. Please come with me, sing our invitation together this morning.